On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The barking, the wire fences, the dingy blankets, and the concrete. That, more often than not, is the sadness that is the dog shelter. And why not? Each year, 4 million dogs are brought to shelters nationwide, and half are euthanized. But one animal shelter worker is on a mission to change all that. By analyzing the way dogs are tested as potential adoptees, and analyzing the adopters themselves, she's working to make the dog shelter a more promising meeting place for man and canine, rather than a last stop for dogs. Up next on Point, a new kind of dog shelter. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Diane Mollahan. She is a graduate student in psychology at the University of Texas in Austin, and she also works at the Town Lake Animal Center in that city as an animal behavior researcher. Prior to that, she was an animal control officer in Boston and worked in that city's Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us from New York is Charles Siebert. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. His cover story, An Elephant Crack-Up, appeared last October, and he is at work on Humanzi, a book about humans and chimpanzees. This Sunday's magazine features an article he's written about Mollahan and her work. It is called New Tricks. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Linda. Nice to be here.
Thank you both very much for being with us. We have a lot of questions about this, and I think many of our listeners are going to be very, very interested in what you have to say. Diane, let us start with you. You are an animal behavior researcher. What is it that you're trying to do with this research?
Well, right now, what I'm doing at the shelter is attempting to assess the validity of temperament assessments that have been used across the country, not just in the U.S., but in Canada and also in Europe. And I'm basically trying to see if these tests are actually measuring what they claim to be measuring, such as personality traits such as sociability, aggression, excitability.
Because you're trying to find, in a nutshell, more homes for abandoned dogs. How much of a problem is abandonment of dogs right now?
Well, Linda, I mean, there are many reasons why relationships fail between people and their pets, and some of them are related to personal issues of the owner, such as moving or landlord issues or just people getting in over their heads. And then there are a number of dogs that are relinquished because of behavior problems. And part of this research is sort of looking at trying to tease apart, what kind can we predict problem behaviors by using these personality assessments. So then when we rehome these animals, we can sort of match the owner's expectation of the kind of pet that they're getting, so to sort of ensure a more successful relationship and provide new owners tools with how to deal with these problem behaviors.
Rehome is such an interesting and poignant word. Charles Siebert, you set off to write this story about the animal shelter and about Diane's work. I'd like to bring you in here, too. You wrote about some astonishing reasons that people have given for abandoning their pets. If you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, these are some of the things Diane made me privy to, but as I say in the piece, the reasons range from the fraught to the frivolous, and Diane mentioned some of them. I mean, people have life changes, they move, there are sometimes they lose a job, whatever, and there's some sometimes very serious behavioral issues. But then on the frivolous end, there are things like Diane mentioned to me, a number of people saying they'd returned their dog because they'd gotten new furniture and the dog's coat didn't match. I've heard other stories of people turning in their dog because they went off on vacation. I've even heard the obverse of that, people getting a dog specifically for their vacation and then relinquishing the dog. So there's quite a range of these things. Pretty astonishing.
And Diane, you wanted to add to that?
Oh, just one of the just more recently, one of the most sort of nonsensical reasons that I've come across was just to add to the list of Charles's frivolous list of relinquishment reasons was the owner gave up their dog because the dog escapes the yard. And then reading down the sort of the owner relinquishment profile, we find out that the owner didn't have a fence around their yard to contain the animal. So some, you know, it definitely varies.
but the problem here, I mean, because this is in many ways a tragedy. 2 million dogs being euthanized every year. What is it that you are doing at the shelter, Diane, to try to make for the better match? I understand, for example, that you use costumes and props. How do you evaluate the dog's various qualities?
Well, the goal of a good temperament assessment or personality assessment is to expose the dog to as many different stimuli that it may encounter when it's outside the shelter. The shelter is a very artificial environment, so we try and simulate sort of strange people that a lot of dogs may be leery of, people in uniforms, or may not have been exposed to someone in a raincoat or seen an umbrella. So the test battery, ideally would want to include as many different sort of test stimuli, lots of, you know, exposing the dogs to other dogs, exposing them. One of our tests involve using toddler dolls, which are these my size Barbies, and which not are my size, but for a 3-year-old, and as a way to try and get a sense of if the dogs are going to be aggressive or fearful towards children, for obvious logistical reasons, we can't use real children, and then we'll use stimuli such as artificial cats to see if how the dogs respond to cats. So we want to get as broad and sort of a rich behaviors information set from as many dogs as we can, so we can, you know, have a sense of, you know, how this dog is going to respond to real world situations.
Because you said that what is at the heart of the problem so many times is unrealistic expectations on the part of the dog, a dog owner, the person who acquires the dog either by buying or adopting. What are those unrealistic expectations in so many of these cases?
Well, I think that a lot of individuals come to shelters and they'll choose a dog based on looks and not really pay much attention to the behavior traits that go alongside those looks, or perhaps overlook them. So, Jack Russell Terriers are sort of the classic example of, people have seen them on TV. They've been popularized, you know, by many TV shows, and they've become very desirable. But terriers are quite independent. They've been bred to hunt rats, and they can sometimes have high energy levels and are not the most people oriented dogs, and take, you know, pretty need a strong benevolent leader to live with. And I know, Charles, you have had experience with terriers. Do you think terriers are for everybody?
Well,
no,
Well, go ahead, Charles.
Okay. No, they're a prime example of something that was very interesting to me in this piece is this whole. First of all, one of the first dogs I came upon there was a fox terrier, and Diane and also the assistant director of the shelter named Dorinda Pulliam had mentioned to me that there's a rash of abandoned fox terriers, and one of the reasons is because, as Diane is saying, these are dogs that were meant to sort of. Well, the word terrier, of the tear at the earth, of the earth, and, you know, they're real diggers and rotters and high energy, but more and more dogs are being pulled away from their original tasks. Dorinda refers to it as dog unemployment. Dogs are now, we're asking them to be our sort of, our animate worry beads and companions in apartments way, way away from the earth, and so here are these dogs literally bouncing off our walls, and so people, this goes to what Diane's saying, you know, they want the terrier because they've heard about it and they heard it's really spunky and smart, but people fail to entertain all those dogs that kind of dog's needs, and then are disappointed when they find that their couch got ripped up like the earth would have been if the dog was allowed to be. So you get that kind of thing a lot now, more and more, as dogs are being pulled away from their original tasks. And another thing that the thing that exacerbates that is the breeders of these dogs are still breeding them for these traits that they no longer really get to apply. instead of trying to breed away from that to and modulate them in a way we could to meet more the today's role, which is to be, you know, our companions in our apartments,
yes,
kind of deal. So.
Hurting, not hurting sheep anymore, but hurting your pillows. You know, Charles, you also mentioned that people try to anthropomorphize dogs, mm-hmm. try to treat them as though they are children. What's wrong with that?
Well, they're dogs. I mean, in a nutshell. I mean, look, we all do that. I mean, I have two dogs, both terrier mixes, as a matter of fact, and I don't have children, and I've examined, is this child substitution? I don't know. I mean, I walk around and talk all day to my dogs like a lunatic, and I think a lot of people do. And if someone were to tape it and listen to it, they'd probably think I was out of my mind. But... you know, I think I have a healthy perspective on it, and I also know to exercise my dogs, and I have a lot of experience. Whereas, I think when people do this kind of anthropomorphizing willy-nilly or unselfconsciously, they're kind of warping the animal in a sense, because they're just not remembering that this is. You know, they're not remembering the needs of the animal.
Diane, we want to get to our callers here, but one of the questions that I wanted to ask you just right off the bat is there one particular quality that will cause you to say this dog is not adoptable, which means the dog will have to be put down?
Well, most shelters, actually the one that I work in Austin, is... basically run by the health department. So putting out what we'd call dangerous or aggressive animals back into the community would probably be the number one reason why animals would be euthanized. Animals coming in with a bite history usually don't get a second chance. So that would probably be the number one reason. And that's basically for liability concerns. Most shelters, whether they be public or private, are not, you know, willing to take that risk.
Okay, we're going to go to our callers now. Joanne is calling from Hannibal, Missouri. Joanne, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
A couple of comments or questions. As I've been waiting, I've been listening and heard one of your guests talk about the anthropomorphizing our animals, which, of course, I'm guilty of. I have two cats, and I'm completely over the moon about them. But I'm also, and I think that may be a problem, but one of my comments is we may... part of this problem with abandonment of dogs has to do with the other end of the spectrum, where people consider dogs just accessories or property, as in a couple or a person who turns in a dog because its coat doesn't match the furniture. I'm very, very disturbed about that kind of viewing of dogs or other animals merely as property with no sensitivity to their to the fact that they're sentient beings with real social needs. That's number one. And number two, Your guests have brought up a question for me that I've had for a long time. These AKC dog shows that breed dogs, that reward breeding of dogs to their old behaviors, the breeding and herding behaviors, and et cetera, et cetera. And one of your guests said, well, they're now less, they don't do those kinds of things anymore. They're unemployed, so to speak. So what are your guests' views on the dog shows that continue to reward breeders for breeding to a standard that may no longer apply? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Diane, let's ask you that question. That's a very good question. Charles, I want to get to you on this as well, because you've talked about the growing dog mania. There is so much interest in owning certain kinds of dogs. But Diane, are the breeders and the dog shows at fault here?
Well, it's difficult to say because there's such a broad range, such a broad distribution of breeders. I mean, coming from puppy mills to backyard breeders to responsible breeders, I think that there are a number of breeders out there that are responsible and do make, you know, cognizant, you know, decisions and of sort of propagating healthy genes. You know, I do have to agree with Charles that, you know, there has been this shift, this sort of kind of mini evolution of dogs, where you know we're putting on you know we have new expectations of them, and problems occur because these dogs aren't getting a chance to do what they've been bred to do. As far as changing, you know, I don't know, having worked in animal sheltering most of my life, I'm not privy to sort of the politics of dog breeding, but I think that if, you know, I think it definitely, you know, it would be nice to sort of raise public awareness about, you know, breeding, about breeders breeding responsibly and also realistically. And, but also, I mean, my sort of, you know, sort of soapbox is raising the bar on pet ownership. So just as the caller, you know, suggested that, you know, outside of anthropomorphism, people, you know, the sort of this, you know, historical cultural relationship with animals, treating them as, you know, domestic livestock. And there's this whole sort of concept of ownership that doesn't always sort of lend itself to that person feeling they're responsible for the length, you know, the length of the life of that pet. So I think that, you know, I really don't know how to answer the question about are breeders becoming more aware that these dogs are unemployed and that they are unemployable and they are, you know, causing problems for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But I'm, you know, I think that until sort of, you know, public awareness reaches a certain level, I don't think that they're going, I don't think there's going to be much of a shift there.
Charles,
so hopefully this will be a start.
Mm-hmm. And Charles, when you write about dog mania, what are you talking about?
Well, I guess, you know, it's hard to codify all this stuff because, as Diane's saying, you know, there are responsible breeders and responsible owners, and I guess those breeders at dog shows, whatever one thinks about them, these are people who are highly educated in what these dogs are and do. And but there are people, I think the thing that Diane hits upon is there's a lot of, there's a, I guess, a big education curve that needs to be occur in this country, given the increased mania over dogs. I mean, there's some 74 million dogs owned by Americans now. And I think where we're running into problems is a lot of people come into dog ownership with, the, you know, they're not seasoned at this. They come at these dogs with, again, these unrealistic expectations, and they don't have very much patience. I mean, if you know, one, I saw just a, you know, harrowing scene that is repeated at shelters across the country daily. But when I was at Town Lake and about to meet with Diane one afternoon for some trade assessments, and you know, the so-called meat truck pulled into the back of the shelter, and this was to pick up a day and a half's worth of euthanized dogs, and I saw 50 dogs just get thrown out into a pile. And, you know, I asked Diane later, I said, well, what about those dogs? I mean, what would you say? Would you say the majority of those could have made pets with just a little work? And she agreed to that, basically. I mean, it's hard to put a number. And Diane has taken some dogs that, you know, have even shown that kind of bite aggression that she referred to, that usually is a death sentence for a dog. And there's this one dog in the piece that we talk about who was that kind of a dog, but because some woman had fallen in love with this one dog, she insisted to Diane that, you know, I need that dog, I want that dog. And Diane went the extra mile and took this dog, a dog that, given all of its ostensible behaviors, would probably not have made it. She kept it in the office with her and sort of day by day conditioned this dog. And you should see this dog now. We went and visited this dog in this home. It's a classic rags to riches story. This dog was found in some apartment complex in a, you know, it was really run down part of Austin. And Diane said that the only information on this dog was found in a room. This was all they knew about this dog. And then we go to this house where this dog has been homed, and you should see this house. It's this gorgeous, you know, manse in this really tony part of Austin. It's a great rags to riches story. And this dog is, you know, merrily getting along. I think it's only with the child in this house, and I think its only remaining pathology is it refuses to go up steps. but you know, I mean, it just shows you just an ounce of behavioral training. A little time can transform these dogs that were, to go back to your question, you know, bouncing off walls and neurotic. People, time and again, Diane had told me that, you know, dogs are just, people have, will just, you know, just, they're moving on in their lives. They're doing this, they don't have time. And the dog chews up a few things and they'll they just get impatient and just dump it off. And with just a little time, that dog could be, you know, totally taken care of. Well, so it's education.
Let's bring in, first of all, what a sad image that you just described there. But let's bring in now another voice. We have with us Stephen Zawasowski, who is the Executive Vice President of the ASPCA. That's the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which is based in New York City. Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'd like to ask you, listening to the hope in Charles's voice that every animal with enough work could be made adoptable, and all of the techniques that Diane is applying to evaluating problems in dog behavior, but how realistic is it for shelters, do you think, to take the time to go through these steps to make a dog adoptable or to evaluate a dog?
Well, good afternoon, and hi, Diane. It's been a while since I talked to you, probably a couple of weeks. I think one of the things that we're seeing now is that the overall standards for animal shelters are changing dramatically. We're seeing that partly because of the dog mania that you've been talking about, greater demands are being put on shelters. And when I first started at the ASPCA, I was probably the first behaviorist to make a full-time career working at an animal shelter. And I think what's really incredible now is we've got people like Diane who are doing their graduate work, concentrating on working with dogs through the shelters. And we're seeing that more people are starting to really think about the behavior.
But isn't there a cost involved here? And how are most, Stephen, how are most of these shelters financed?
Well, most shelters around the country are going to be either financed as a municipal-run shelter. It comes out of your taxes and the fees that are charged by that shelter. Or they're a nonprofit humane society, and they raise their money just the way any other NPR station would, by donations from members, fees that they get.
But is, in other words, with those sources of funds, is it feasible to put this kind of effort into it?
I think it's absolutely unconscionable if we don't. Pets are a $40 billion industry in this country. It's bigger than the child toy industry. It's bigger than the candy industry. Right now, if we had just a small portion of that money coming into shelters, and that would be a tremendous boon. The fact is, for the pet industry, we're cleaning up parts of their mess. They sell themselves to the public, their products, with the human-animal bond. We're fixing those parts of the human-animal bond that have been broken.
Let's bring in Gina from Virginia Beach, who's on the phone here. Virginia Beach, Virginia. Gina, go ahead.
Hello, Linda. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for talking about this subject. I adopted a 5-year-old dog 10 years ago from my local SPCA, and she's a recognized AKC breed. She's a beautiful dog. She recently passed away. I recommend everybody to look at their shelters when they're thinking about a companion animal before buying one from a breeder. But my comment is I feel like the shelters can only do so much, and that the real problem is the overpopulation of pets. And I just wish we could see some stronger legislation with spaying and neutering animals, with stronger licenses of who can sell animals. I know that there's very good breeders out there, but I also know there's people that, you know, get together with their buddy and they have a litter of puppies and then they try to make money off of it. And, you know, maybe even making it illegal for people to give away their puppies, you know, making there be more responsibility in pet owners to make sure that they're not contributing to the overpopulation. And I'm just wondering what your guests and especially Stephen feels about this.
What do you have to say about that, Stephen? Because clearly it is a money-making industry. That is, there's no question about that. The breeding of the very breed that, as Charles has been telling us, might not be the right breed for a small apartment in New York.
Well, actually, what's interesting is bringing up the concept of spaying and neutering and the question of the where dogs come from. Most of the dogs that people have don't come through any part of the industry that's well organized, either through shelters or through breeders. Most of the pets that people acquire come from friends and family and neighbors. And it really does come down to those folks who have these unplanned litters where the dog gets out, it hasn't been spayed, they got the puppies, and they're starting to spread them around. Now, what we know is that the overpopulation problem is being reduced pretty dramatically in a number of areas of the country. We've had substantial success up in the Northeast, the West Coast in a number of places are doing quite well. Areas up along the Northern Great Lakes are doing well. And it's been a function of highly accessible, subsidized spaying and neutering for parts of the population, the people who don't have the money to have their dogs spayed and neutered on their own. And that's really another important role of animal shelters, is to develop these kinds of outreach spay-neuter programs.
Okay, well, thank you, Stephen Zawiselski, very much the Executive Vice President and Science Advisor for the ASPCA, for joining us. I'd like to go now, if I could, to Craig, who is calling from Savannah, Georgia. And Craig, tell us your story about adopting your dog.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for taking my call. Recently, actually in January, went to the Humane Society and got a very large dog. Actually, she's part boxer and part hound, which is an interesting combination, and just a delightful dog. My experience was very unique. I was so surprised that the Humane Society, first of all, it kind of felt like we were filling out an application to buy a house or and or adopt a child. And I was shocked by the detail that they asked. And also, the Humane Society in this area is just extremely busy, and you can tell just by the amount. I mean, there are a lot of dogs on the streets in this town and in some of the areas. So they really have an overwhelming challenge on their hand. And I was absolutely amazed that with the type of breed that we had, because being a boxer and needing space to run around and exercise, and they actually came and did a home visit to make sure that what we had said, that, you know, had a fenced-in backyard, that it was factual and everything, and you had to be totally accepted in order to take this dog. And I've adopted two other pets from animal shelters, and this was quite a unique experience, and I don't know how they can even keep up with the volume they have.
Joining me this hour from Austin, Austin, Texas, is Diane Mollahan, a graduate student in psychology at the University of Texas in Austin. She also works at the Town Lake Animal Center in that city as an animal behavior researcher. And joining us from New York is Charles Siebert. He is a contributing writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. This Sunday's magazine features an article he's written about Mollahan and her work. It is called New Tricks, and it also tells the tale, Charles, of your own love affair with the dog that you discovered while writing this story. So, first of all, how were you evaluated as an adoptive parent?
Well, I did the classic thing of losing my journalistic objectivity, my reporterly remove, in the course of hanging out with Diane. I think it was all Diane's scheme, now that I think back on it. I think she lured me past this one kennel where this just unbelievably drop-dead cute dog was. Had two names at the time. The dog was twice abandoned, named Cricket Olive. And it was not where usually the cutesy dogs are. They're usually up front in the shelter. This one was in the back building, surrounded by rather like larger, excitable dogs. Yeah, ominous. And in the midst of them, here's this little, animate piece of carpet lint with button eyes, you know, coming up mutely and looking at me. And to answer your question, Linda, I think I, from the beginning, was making all the classic mistakes that Diane was referring to about, you know, judging, going by first appearance and looks. And, you know, if on the form it says, you know, why did you choose this dog? And one of them says, love at first sight. And I wrote, duh, because I just melted and I became obsessed. And, you know, I poor Diane, I mean, I was dragging her back to the office, making her look up all the information on this dog. But I will say, over time, when I was given a little time to calm down, although I didn't rest until I got this dog, and I have to tell you, I was number four on the list, and I managed to work my way up that list through various means that Diane was privy to.
Didn't you actually stalk?
I did. I stalked
one of the people on the list.
Exactly. We got to Let's see. I got to number two on the list, which is a rescue group. And Diane, so everything was legal, but Diane got the rescue group, which, you know, they assign themselves to specific breeds usually, or dog, really cute dogs. And Olive was spoken for by a rescue group. And what they do is find an adopt, you know, an adopter, an ideal adopter for that dog. So Diane got me an interview with the liaison to the rescue group from the shelter, and she was convinced of my passion and my dog owner, you know, credibility, because I already had a shelter dog. And so she made the rescue group defer to me. So now I only had to wait out one guy, and he's the one who I started to stalk. And I literally filed a Freedom of Information Act and got his phone number and started calling the poor guy up to, like, make him declare his intentions. Like, do you want this dog? And, you know, and if you do, I'm going to talk you out of it. And I was even willing to pay him money. I don't think he should have known that, but because I probably would have given him an ungodly sum. This is how bad I got. And then finally, Diane and I agreed that maybe I shouldn't. He never answered, by the way. I called him like four or five times in a row. He had about a day and a half before his deadline passed and the dog would become mine. And I called about four times, and the fourth time the phone was just picked up and smashed down. And I turned to Diane and said, he's got anger issues. He should be disqualified from having this dog. But turned out he never came forward. I waited out the deadline, and I got Olive. I chose Olive of the Olive Cricket.
And I gather it was a happy relationship.
I cannot tell you. I do not to this day know what possibly could have led to this dog being twice abandoned. I kept, you know, thinking there must be a devil beneath the you know, that cute exterior. And I waited, and Diane and I stayed in touch, you know, when I got back to New York, and I, you know, would daily almost report back and say, no devil yet. I mean, this dog, yeah. There was nothing. I mean, the only thing each dog that a person adopts from a shelter is a vessel of a past relationship, and sometimes a pretty sordid one it can be. And you don't know what that dog carries with it. And psychologically, I will say that Olive, although unbelievably well-tempered and the nicest, sweetest dog, she did when and still to this day, when you go to pick her up, she flinches and cowers a little bit. And the first time she heard a loud noise in our apartment, I think I slapped a mosquito on the wall or something, and she just bolted into a corner and sort of just trembled. And it made me wonder, you know, that's the thing about a shelter dog. You're looking through them as a prism into whatever their past was. And I thought, maybe this dog saw domestic violence, or maybe this dog was hit. You know, there's something like that.
But it sounds like she's found domestic bliss now. And so
she
just
has.
And
she
you can
sleeps
see
entwined with my other dog.
You know, and those of you who are listening out there, you can see a picture of Olive, Charles Siebert's dog, which he adopted from the Town Lake Animal Center in Austin, by going to our website, onpointradio.org. And let's go to some more callers now. Rob is calling from Abington, Massachusetts. Rob, go ahead.
Hi, my wife and I just adopted a dog named Luke from a shelter 3 weeks ago, and we went through a fairly usual process of going through petfinder.com and trying to match up characteristics that we were looking for. And I then shared lots of correspondence with the shelter, both through the adoption form, email questions, which were numerous, and even some phone calls. And they eventually called two of my references and said we could adopt this dog, and it was predicated on me visiting the dog, which was about an hour and a half away. I found this dog at a shelter about an hour and a half from me, and I took the drive to meet it. But one of the things I'd say is that my dog ended up being sometimes much more aggressive than advertised. So I understand that there are issues with some of the people who are doing the adopting, but it seemed to me that the shelter put this dog in its absolute most favorable light to place the animal. And while we're going to work with this dog and, you know, everything we hope is going to be fine, I'm wondering what your panel could describe as the average shelter. And from there, where might I also get more training and behavior resources?
Well, Diane, that's a very – thank you very much, Robin. That's a very good question for you, Diane.
Yeah, that's a really important point, and that's one of the things that with temperament assessing – like I was saying, you know, we're in, you know, this sort of unrealistic environment where we're testing these dogs for resource aggression or strange regression or aggression towards you know, life-size Barbies, which may not generalize to real children. One of the things with aggression that makes it very difficult to assess in a shelter is a lot of it has to do with the relationship with the owner. So a lot of aggression, such as possessive aggression or protective aggression, isn't going to show up until the dog is in a home. And then sometimes there's going to be a honeymoon period, which I'm really happy that Charles' honeymoon period is still happening with Olive. Having not knowing enough information about whether the animal was screened for aggression at the shelter, that would be my first question. But I'd also have to say that, you know, there's no, personality assessment, either human or animal, that's 100% predictable. So there's always going to be your false positives and false negatives.
But are there things, Diane, that one should look for when looking at a shelter? I mean, you walk into a building. What should you be looking for at the shelter?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's quite unique about the shelter in Austin is we have a PhD certified animal behaviorist on staff. And like Steve was saying, he was one of the first to be hired at the ASPCA. So one of the first questions would be to find out if there is a behavior department. Not all shelters have the resources to conduct temperament assessments because they're quite expensive and they take up resources that shelters sometimes, they're lucky if they have three walls. So first would be to, gain access to as much behavioral information as the shelter has acquired on a particular dog. And I can't say I haven't heard of rescue groups or shelters that do withhold information and have adopted out dogs and have, fatalities have happened as a result. So I think that the first, course action would be to find out if there's a behavior department and if a temperament test has been conducted and what was the results of those temperament assessments. And if the animal was surrendered by a previous owner, then the new owner should have access to that information. And part of my study is improving the instruments that we use to collect information from individual owners and also once the animals are placed in their home, because I think having good quality information is key in trying to best narrow that expectation gaps. What your caller seems to be experiencing right now is he wasn't prepared for having to deal with aggression. As far as what resources are there, the best place to start would be to go to the Animal Behavior Society website and to look up. There is a list of certified animal behaviorists who are animal behaviorists who have a PhD or a DVM or a master's or all three in some cases. And these are people that are specialized and trained in dealing with behavior issues. And especially something like aggression, is you don't want to put yourself in the hands of someone who doesn't have those credentials.
Don't you, Diane, have to make what are essentially life and death decisions, and so do people at shelters who make these evaluations, based on often a very brief exposure to the dog. You talked, Charles wrote about something called conditioned frustration, where a dog might seem to be aggressive, but actually just wanted a walk. I mean, how do you make those kinds of judgments?
Well, it can be difficult to tease apart what exactly is going on, and most shelters hopefully are taking steps to, to when these animals are identified, and usually it's caused by stress or being at the shelter a long time, is giving them productive outlets of their energy. So most dogs in shelters are, most people think they need to run, most dogs are overstimulated, so they need structure. So one way of ascertaining if a dog is really aggressive versus being what we call, showing frustration aggression or barrier frustration, or a dog that's barking at a kennel gate, is to take that dog out of that situation and expose it to dogs under other circumstances. So it really involves, exposing the dog to lots of different types of stimuli to see if that response is generalized. But typically, if a dog does, show aggression towards humans, in most shelters, that dog is most likely going to be euthanized. Fortunately, dogs learn from aggression. So if it's, learned to bite to sort of get what it wants, then it's more likely to do that again.
Let's go to Violet now, who is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina.
Hello. I appreciate you letting me speak to you. We've had a couple of, we have three beagles, and we're babysitting a basset hound, but in the past we've adopted dogs to one of our beagles is adopted, and we were living in Louisiana, and he was a hunting dog, and he didn't hunt, and so he was abused kind of badly, and when we got him, he had heartworm, and we absolutely love him, but he does have some issues with some people. It's mm-hmm. almost like he can really judge a character, mm-hmm. Someone who might be abusive to him. There are people he absolutely loves, and at first glance, without any, it doesn't seem like he would know them very well, but he can tell right away that they might not be somebody he likes, and I was wondering if anyone has ever noticed that with other dogs.
Either one of you, Diane, Charles? Diane, you want to take that one?
There are dogs that respond to different people. A lot of dogs don't like men because they typically are taller, so they're more threatening stimuli. Just sort of a species sort of specific thing about dogs is guys with beards or people with hats that are removing sort of visual information from the dog. Because, you know, dogs are, you know, going to evaluate you, and they want to be able to see your eyes, and they want to be able to see your mouth, and they want to be able to see your head. And when you sort of mask any of those things, sometimes dogs, you know, feel more threatened. I know there are some people that are just very jittery around dogs, and dogs are much more likely to trust people who have more sort of predictive body movements. That's why toddlers are typically at risk of being bitten by dogs, because they sort of have a pretty ataxic gait and kind of unpredictable behavior.
Charles, when you filled out Diane's incredibly lengthy questionnaire, what what were the qualities that she was looking for in you, the future owner of Olive?
Uh-oh, I have to defer to Diane on that. But,
what were you trying to sell about yourself?
Well, of course, my inimitable sanity and it was that I had, beyond my initial love at first sight thing, that one, I had experience that I had been through three or four different dogs, that I had very sound reasons beyond the cute factor, which is that I was getting the distinct feeling that my terrier dog, my adopted shelter terrier dog at home, was kind of bored and could use a companion.
Do dogs get bored?
That's a thing. Diane verified. Yeah, and we did have that conversation, as a matter of fact, as she was interviewing me, and the idea that logistics too. Like, yes, I'm a Brooklynite and live in an apartment, but I live near like one of the best all-time dog parks in the world, in Prospect Park, where dogs get to run off the lead at certain hours. And so, you know, all those elements. And I wanted a small dog because I travel a lot as a writer, and my other terrier is small. And I thought, boy, Olive fits that too. She's about 13 pounds. And, you know, I when I got the dog, I went out and got a little carry case. And I knew this dog would fit right in, you know, with me on the airplane. And sure enough, you know, I could just carry on luggage. And the flight was delayed 2 hours. And 6 hours, that dog was in that bag and didn't make a sound, so it was pretty incredible. So yeah, I think it was pretty clear to Diane. I hope that you know, this wasn't just a irresponsible love at first sight thing, that I had some chops.
But it does sound, Charles, as though there's real love here. And you are writing, this is going to be our sort of our closing bit of thought here. You're writing a story about dog love between a man and dog. What is that?
What is that?
Love between a person and a dog. Why do they love each other, man and dog?
I'm going to utter a cliche here. I mean, one aspect of it is that kind of, you know, that unconditional devotion to you that dogs emit. I guess that's just that really is a big part of it, that partnership and companionship. It's irreplaceable, and it has been. I mean, that goes to the heart of why we've been with dogs for so many centuries. It's one of the most satisfying emotions you can have, in a way.
And with that will be our final thought, a wonderful thought. Thank you so much to Charles Siebert and Diane Mollahan. You can continue the conversation online and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Linda Douglas, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.